Okay, well, are we ready? Let's get started.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Tuesday, September 4th regular board meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District. The board did not meet in closed session this evening. Let's go on to approval of the minutes for 8:14. Do we have a motion on the approval of minutes for 8:14?
I'll move approval.
We have a motion to approve those minutes. Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
We have a second by Mr. Quisenberry. Any discussion? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board for a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carries 6-0. Let's move on to the minutes of 8:21. Would somebody like to make a motion on that one?
I will move to approve those minutes.
Okay, so we have a motion to approve. Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Seconded by Mr. Quisenberry. Again, do we have any discussion on those? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board. I am going to abstain on those minutes because I was not at that meeting. So all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? We have two abstentions. Carries 4-0. Let's move on to item number 3.1. That would be student representatives to the board. And don't see anybody here tonight. We miss our... We're always happy when our students come and talk to us, and they're a great addition to what we do. We'll move on to correspondence. The board did not receive any correspondence this evening, so we'll go on past that, and we'll get to public comment. Is there anyone? I'm sorry, Mrs. Roger.
I received electronic correspondence from Sharon Hout at the IMC/Morro Bay High School Library, and I believe it was that we were each copy recipients.
That's correct, yes.
She sent us an article having to do with the importance of libraries and reading for students.
Great, and thanks to Mrs. Haupt. Now we'll move on to public comment, and I apologize for that. Is there anyone from the public that would like to address the board? Seeing no one, we'll move on to item number 6, the superintendent's updates. Dr. Prater.
Yeah, this evening we're going to have at least two-thirds of the summer school update presentation for you. Dr. Delkiskamp is unable to be here this evening, but she will present the secondary summer school update at a later time, probably the next board meeting. So tonight we have...
Summer 2012 was based around that core philosophy of Initiative 1, to achieve substantial academic gains with specific student populations. In other words, we wanted to take the steps of walking the talk of all means all. We were also committed to research-based intervention curriculum for each of our targeted students. And finally, we were committed to recruit and hire San Luis Coastal Unified School District teachers and staff whenever possible to work with our students in our summer programs. We believe that the caliber of our teachers and paraprofessionals, along with the investment that our district has made in ongoing professional development, have made it critical that we get these best of the best teachers working with our students who require summer intervention. In fact, this summer in elementary, 31 of our 33 teachers were current San Luis Coastal employees. So for some elementary highlights, we had two district-run summer programs that were held at C.L. Smith and Del Mar. In past, parents have always had to choose for summer school. Is my child going to be in a ELA, or are they going to get a math intervention? And this was fine, but what we have found and what I found back when I was at C.L. Smith is that many of the children that we encourage to attend district summer programs, they need extra support in both areas. And so with that, the first thing that we did was to restructure our offerings so that all children received a program that included English language arts and mathematics. For the nearly half of our students who are English language learners that were enrolled in our summer programs, they also received ELD instruction, either through a pull-out or a push-in during the ELA time. Thank you. We also focused on developing targeted interventions, a specific target intervention curriculum. When appropriate, we used pre- and post-assessments to measure student success. In a 19-day summer school program, which is exactly how long it lasts, we were able to collect data on student achievement in our targeted math intervention. And finally, we provided professional development for all of our teachers in the math intervention curriculum. We felt that this was critical for our interventions in order for them to be effective. In English language arts, in our district programs, this should look pretty familiar to you. Comprehensive literacy provided the structure for focusing our support for our below grade level readers. Using the reader's workshop model, students worked at their specific instructional level in small guided reading groups. Our goal in ELA was to help struggling students maintain gains made during the school year, as well as increase their confidence and competence. Writer's workshop was another integral daily part of English language arts for our students, thanks to the fact that our teachers had just attended 4 days of the Writing Institute. All of our students were writing daily and developing strategies in revision and editing. Jill Larson, our math instructional coach, did nothing less than a heroic job of putting together our math intervention curriculum for our K-5 math students. I'm going to ask her to share it with you, as well as the results from our math assessments.
Thank you for that introduction. In our math program, we made an intentional effort to close the achievement gap by having a summer school program that was focused particularly on structure and strategies in math. These were the four components that we used: the Do the Math intervention modules, Fast Math, Fraction Nation, and the Computational Fluency Kits that I'll talk more about. The Computational Fluency Kits help the students learn some fact automaticity, and they were done with paper and pencil and games, and we're looking forward to having more data from those. But the other three programs, we have data that I'm going to share in the next three slides. So Do the Math is an intervention program that has been created by Marilyn Burns, and it is a targeted intervention program in whole numbers and fractions, and it's intended for a group of 8 students. There's a pre-assessment so that you can identify which module the students should be in order to best meet their needs, and it's 30 minutes for 30 days, 5 days a week. So as Amy said, our program was 19 days, but you can see the success that we had in 19 days with 65% of our summer school participants in this program gaining 10 or more percentage points. So the initial results are quite positive with that program. Clicking for the first time and talking. Fast Math is a research-based, all these programs are research-based, and Fast Math is a research-based program that's online and it's individualized, and students take a placement test, and it's computer-fitted the most from this program during our summer school. We had very positive initial results after 19 days of these programs, and two anecdotal positive things as well are that out in the community, I heard a parent talking about how fabulous the summer school program was, and he was explaining that it just changed his child's life, and that's always nice to hear when there's positive feedback from the parent community. And I am being inundated by emails from teachers going, so where are these programs? When are we going to get them? And right now we're working on protocols to get them out into the classroom. So I also take that as a very good sign, because those were our own teachers, like Amy said, using these programs. Thank you.
So I want to share a little information with you. A little bit of data on who attended summer school. This slide shows you our two district classes, the one at Del Mar and at C.L. Smith, as well as site-run programs that were offered at Baywood, Bishop's Peak, Hawthorne, and Pacheco. You can see, and this is a fact of life that we've dealt with for many years with our summer programs, that we had 653 students who enrolled and attended at least one day. We had 481 students who completed 80% of the summer program at their site. Attendance at summer school has historically been difficult to maintain. It's critical, as we know, for students to gain success in a 19-day program. This next graph shows you the percentage of students who had an 80% attendance rate or better during summer school by their school. If we look at the next one, this goes on to look at our children who attended summer school by grade level. This, since research tells us we want to help students close that gap before it gets too large, I'm somewhat pleased to see that the high percentages of students in our kindergarten, first, second, and third grade, where we have the best chance of helping them to catch up. Initiative 1, as you know, identifies specific student populations we need to focus on to close that achievement gap, including Hispanic, socioeconomically disadvantaged, and English learners. As you can see from this slide, we have high percentages of students in our targeted populations attending summer school. Nearly half of all students attending were English learners.
Amy, yes. Could you just make sure that I understand the distinction between English learner and Hispanic? How is that sorted out for...
An English learner is any student whose first language is other than English. Most often in our district, that first language is Spanish. A Hispanic student is a student of a nationality that they would put on their... When they enroll, they identify themselves as Hispanic, and they may or may not be an English learner. But what is interesting to note about this slide, that for each of those specific populations described, a student may be a member in one, two, or all three of those categories. I'm going to very quickly, because I think because they're so unique, it would be worth your knowing how our different site-run summer schools, what they look like this summer. I'm going to start with Baywood. They ran a K-1 and a 2-5 program for 60 students. Their kindergarten, first, and second grade students had the opportunity to participate in level literacy intervention, which you've heard me talk about before. What was unique about it is they had students who had started the program during the school year, and then they continued it on into the summer program. Their math intervention program included the Do the Math program that Jill spoke to you about earlier. And again, students were able to complete the module that they had started during the school year and finish it during the summer program. As a result, all the students in their Do the Math intervention in multiplication made gains of 10 percentage points or more, which is really quite outstanding. And Jennifer wanted me to include a couple pictures of kids during summer school for you to enjoy. So there you go. Bishop's Peak ran a site-based program for the very first time last summer, and they ran two classes for 30 students, and they chose a very similar format to Baywood. They included readers and writers workshop in both the groups, and they focused on problem-solving in primary and taught a do-the-math module in multiplication for their upper grades. Students, on average, raised their scores in multiplication from 49% on the pretest to an 81% on their post-assessment. Hawthorne had a complete English language arts focus for their summer program. They ran two classes for 34 students, one primary, one upper. Their program included word study and daily guided reading and writing. They used a school design pre-post quick assessment to provide data on the student achievement. And of the 34 students that they had enrolled, 28 of those...
And what percentage was self-referred?
I do not. I would have to say that in our elementary level, none of our children are self-referred, but they might be parent-referred.
Parent-referred.
But if they're parent-referred, they still have to be approved by the teacher. And then this year I added the approved by the principal. And we did this specifically because we wanted kids who needed this time during summer for these programs. It's not an enrichment program. We wanted to make sure that we stayed true to the intervention of the program.
Okay, thank you.
Mrs. Shields, one more question.
I'm coming back, I promise.
Oh, right, this will be quick, yeah.
That's
think.
That's fine.
In relation to the math intervention programs at C.L. Smith and Del Mar,
It was mentioned that two of the programs, I think one was the Fraction Nation, were online programs. Were those accessible only at the sites, or were they accessible both at sites and at home?
Yeah, they are site licenses, so those are just available at the school site.
Thank you.
For special education, the term is extended school year, and so it's an extension of their current school year of their IEPs. And extended school year is IEP-driven. Throughout the school year, the staff take data during winter break and spring break to determine if a student is regressing and is not able to recoup their learning and their goals maintained after a period of time after the return from either of those breaks. That is how they determine whether a student requires extended school year. So data is taken throughout the school year. After they determine that, then we design our classes and build our classes based on the IEPs. We have the registration similar to the summer program. This year, we had 143 students enroll in our extended school year program, all IEP-driven, and we had 20 classrooms, 20 teachers. We also had 57 paraeducators. Some of the students needed more than just one paraeducator in the classroom, and most of the students with more intensive needs attended summer school or extended school year. We took the total number of hours. Attendance is not a concern in extended school year. We have many students attend regularly. If we see that students are not attending, we place those phone calls, and they may be on vacation or an illness, which we will see with students with special needs or seizures. If we do see some of this in the later slide, you'll see that some of the students who did not attend on a regular basis did not make those gains that we would hope to see. The student population, as you could see, we have in pre-K, that's the PK, we have three, potentially enough for three classes this during the summer, because we run an AM-PM in two of the classes now. 30 students were, and over 30 students were enrolled in our summer program, so we had three AM classes. Also, you can see in our K-1-2 had a high population. We're not quite sure why the fifth grade, there was a peak in there, but it is, again, IEP-driven. The MF is the medically fragile class, and those students do attend on a regular basis, and the PREPARE program is the 18 to 22-year-old. Along with our specially designed classes and education and services, we also have designated instructional services. That's the DIS, which is also considered a related service. That's your speech and language services. We have 76 students who required speech and language services, or else they would regress with a recoupment capacity that would not allow them to progress at the beginning of the year at a nice curve that we would like to see. Now, these 76 students, some of them were in classes, in the special day classes, but we also had some speech-only students because they had, in that early intervention, they had some articulation errors that were significant that we wanted to try and really focus on those during the summer. Also, we had one student that required occupational therapy, one who required adaptive PE services during the school year or during the summer. And you know, it's really hard during the school year. It ends, and then you're looking at, ooh, the student is just getting some gross motor refinement and on a roll, and now we're going to have that break. So sometimes we have to make an IEP decision based on that. Additionally, we had three students receiving low-incidence services. Low-incidence is deaf, hard of hearing, blind, deaf-blind, and orthopedically impaired. So there were three students who required that during the summer. Sometimes the transition is too much during the summer. There's a new teacher, there's a new location because it's at C.L. Smith or San Luis High versus their home school, or they were unable to attend due to an illness, or it may be due to their disability.
Hey, Jackie, could I suggest that your chart might look a little better if instead of the purple being 20%, it was down to 2%?
Really? I don't know how to go backwards. Sorry. That's great, great. You know, we had lots of eyes looking at this and didn't notice that. Thank you very much. We'll fix that in the shared drive. And I'm going to pass this over to Amy now that I messed this up.
You're all good. It's fine. It's good.
We're good. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for catching that.
So what we're doing at this point is forward planning. What did we learn from summer programs 2012? And as we begin to evaluate and begin looking forward, we want to improve our services for specific student populations. We want to improve in providing that seamless transition from the school year to summer. I mentioned it a couple times. We've got pockets of it in place, but I think it's one of the places where we really need to hone in and improve what we're doing. And we have some ideas of how we're going to take those next steps. And the first one, I did it again, is we want to expand our use of our common assessment tools. We're developing, we're piloting, we're putting into place these common assessment tools, and now we need to figure out where they fit into our summer programs. It's difficult to find tools that measure growth in a brief program. If our goal is to figure out with our current assessments that we have in place where we might line these up in the summer so that we are able to get some real data that lets us know how our kids are doing and how we're doing in addressing the needs of our children. We also want to improve access to data to inform instruction by better utilizing Data Director. Currently, we get some of our information easily through Data Director, and some of it we're making our classroom teachers write out to hand to the summer school teacher, and I think we could do a better job in streamlining that process with our current what we can get out of Data Director, even with it how it is now. Thirdly, we want to expand our use of research-based curriculum materials such as the Do the Math, Fast Math, and Fractionation that you heard about tonight. Next, we want to continue the professional development for teachers, and we think that day that we offered to our teachers this year was monumental in creating a change. It was really became the key to providing high leverage instructional strategies in our classrooms that wasn't in place before, and we think that that may be the most important thing we do is come up with these programs that target what kids need and make sure the teachers have the strategies to help our kids meet those the needs that they bring. We also want to expand programs to reach more of our students with our shrinking dollars. We haven't figured out this solution yet, but we know it's a reality, and yet we know we want to be able to meet even the needs of more students than we had this last summer. And finally, we want to expand the recruitment of San Luis Coastal teachers and staff to ensure that these summer programs are both rigorous and relevant. And with that, if you have any other questions, we're happy to take them.
Walter and then Catherine.
Amy, the fact that the extended school year is IEP driven, I was kind of seeing it initially as the services and everything that are provided are driven by the IEP, but I'm also getting, is it true that we get a higher participation because whether or not the student needs to have the extended school year is also part of their IEP determination?
I'm going to let Jackie field that one, but I think the answer is yes.
I'm not sure what your question is.
So before the extended school year starts, is the IEP process looking at a student and saying, hey, guess what, we think you could benefit from the extended school year, and that becomes part of their IEP?
Yes, it's required.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, good. And I'm kind of going somewhere with this. So of the other group of students in summer school, have we got a sense of how much, I don't know, I was going to try to put it positively, but how much are we underserving? I mean, are we turning kids away who want to be in our summer school programs?
No, we did not turn any child away that would be appropriate for our summer school programs. It's the recruitment, it's the getting parents to sign kids up. I know our teachers are very diligent about doing this starting in March
at their second parent-teacher conference and having those forms ready to go and encouraging them to sign up. We ask principals to talk to teachers about doing reminders. I know fresh and younger teachers in the last 2, 3, 4 years. A number of those newer teachers who want to supplement their yearly income in the summer became interested in our summer program. And I will tell you, in part, that's part of it. The other part is in moving it over to Instructional Services and Learning Achievement in our office and having observed summer school for many years at C.L. Smith, I was very personally interested in seeing more San Luis Coastal teachers in there. And because I had seen who was there, and they were lovely people, but they didn't know our curriculum, they didn't know our students, they didn't know our programs, they hadn't been to our professional development, and it just seemed like a missed opportunity for our students not to have our teachers teaching them.
Sounds like a win-win.
Yeah. Thank you.
I guess following up on Walt's question a little bit, how many, are you able to have any general idea of how many students you kind of wished would have taken advantage of summer school or participated in it, who for a wide variety of reasons were not able to?
I don't have that at my fingertips, but I know I can access that very easily, and I wonder if I could follow up with a summary for you in the Friday report of that information.
That would be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Be happy to.
Thanks.
Okay. Doesn't look like there are any other questions. Thank you for the great report. It's really nice to see that this supports our student learning and our initiatives. Let's move on to item number 6.02, and that would be the long-lost Mr. Miller.
Where did I go?
We heard you were out of town.
I was. Thank you. While I was out of town, there was actually very little progress on the state budget as it relates to educational issues. Clearly, the legislature and the governor are waiting for the November initiative election and to see what happens with that. There was a lot of flurry of activity leading up to August 31st as a deadline for the passage of bills that had to be sent to the governor for signing, vetoing, or whatever his disposition of them are. I think the one that gained the most media attention was that which reformed the pension plans of public employees. The incoming public employees will have an altered pension outlook than what is currently in place. It wasn't a radical departure from what's there, yet it sent a message that change was coming, and it was, to me, my editorial piece of this, it was surprising that it passed because it wasn't necessarily supported by unions. So for the legislature to depart from that fundamental strength that they have with the unions was surprising to me. But nevertheless, that was the bill that gained the most attention. There were several bills that had education reform as part of them, mandated costs, other things, and they just didn't get enough action by the 31st. Either they went into suspense, which means they'll be held over till the next legislative session, or they simply were dropped because they didn't make the cut. And we'll see what happens. Clearly, all of us are waiting on pins and needles, if you will, for the initiative election in November. That's going to have dramatic effect one way or the other on education in California as we know it.
And that would be Propositions 30 and 38, I believe.
I'm sorry?
That would be Propositions 30 and 38.
Correct.
I have a couple of questions
for
you. The first regards the state teacher retirement system. Are there changes in the state teacher retirement system that can only be made through the Constitution? Is that true?
Some of the state teacher's retirement system, its existence resides within the Constitution. Changes to it, though, can be made legislatively.
Okay, I was under the impression that there were certain changes that could only be made through the constitutional process. I was just wondering about
that. It's possible. I don't know what they would be.
Okay.
But, you know, it'd be easy enough to figure it out if you read the Constitution. I think my point is this. I don't think that there's ever been any concerted effort to change the state teacher retirement system because of the power CTA has. And at this time, it was surprising that it was even discussed. So if you wish, then we can do a quick research of what...
I'm kind of curious because, a concern I have is that with the sense from the public that that pensions are overdone for public employees, which I would disagree with, especially considering that public employees don't get Social Security typically, that given the climate, that something like that might occur.
It would be advantageous then for us to research it. We'll give it back to you as an information item. That's easy enough to do.
And the second question I have is, I know there was work.
This probably looks familiar to you. We bring this to you every year with our unaudited actuals. It's actually a separate form within our unaudited actuals, but we have to bring it forward as a resolution to the board to approve that we're within our GAN limit. The GAN amendment was passed as part of Prop 4 in 1979 for the purpose of limiting government spending, so it keeps us within our growth and inflation. And if you care to look on page 3 of 3 on the GAN form, you can see that we are within our limit. Our adjusted appropriations limit is $66,334,000, and our appropriation subject to the limit is $57,603,000. So we're well within our limit. And with that, I would like to suggest that you approve resolution number 031213.
And let me see if there's anyone from the public that would like to address the board on this item. And seeing no one, I'll bring it back to the board. Would someone like to make a motion on this?
I did have a question.
Yes, Mr. Lamar, sorry.
Julie, I noticed the end of the first paragraph in the description of the agenda item. It talks about amendments increase the amount of state aid counted in local limits, which I assume is decreases something for us.
The amount, well, I think that this is just to allow the state to increase the amount that it can report. So, for instance, if we went over our GAN limit, the state would take that excess and report it as part of the state's limit.
I knew there was, I didn't understand it, but I knew there was something in there, a catch in there somewhere. But we are not in danger of that encroaching on
our
GAN
limit. We're nowhere close, really, because it takes the prior year GAN limit and adds inflation and growth to that.
Right.
So we kind of keep getting further and further from it, really.
Okay, good. Thanks.
So not subject to the revenue limit deficit.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions from board members? Okay, well, we can take a motion on this then if somebody would like to make it. Mrs. Roger.
If Mr. Millar's question is satisfied, then I would move approval of resolution number 031213, the GAN limit calculations for 2011-2012 and estimated calculations for 2012-2013.
Second the motion.
Thank you. Thank you. Is there any further discussion from the board? Seeing none, we'll bring it back to Mrs. Holmes for a roll call vote.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mr. Quessenberry?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Passes unanimously.
Okay. I thought that was on. We'll go to item number 8.01, approval of unaudited year-end actual financial statement. Mrs. Lang.
Thank you. We are also ready to report our unaudited actuals for 11-12 to the board for approval and discussion. This financial report will be the basis of our audit report that's coming up in a couple of weeks. And there were some changes to our ending balance, and I thought we would go through the general fund summary, which you should have on your reports also, so you can follow along either there or on the screen to see what has changed since our second interim report. You can see that our revenues overall went up by about $1.8 million, which was a big surprise. Our revenue limit went up a little bit. That was due to an increase in property taxes, and we got a little bit of an increase in our revenue limit state aid. Federal revenues appear to have gone down, but that's actually just deferred revenues. Those are revenues that we don't book in 11-12. We book them in 12-13.
So it's not really a decrease. The biggest increase was in our state revenues, surprisingly enough. And there are a combination of things that went into this. One of the biggest reasons for the increase was the mental health, the special ed mental health piece, which we knew we were going to get, but at second interim we didn't know how much we were going to get and we didn't know how we were going to get it. So it wasn't budgeted at second interim. It was budgeted at unaudited actuals.
So thinking about that, Julie, I'm assuming that that is considered categorical part of our categorical funding?
Yes.
Is that correct?
It came into us as our partly as special special ed, regular special ed, and then they also set up a special resource code for the mental health piece. As you probably know, the mental health piece came in a lot of different pots of money this year. Part of it was Prop 98, part of it was SB 70. I think they had to kind of sort out how they were going to do that. Our district ended up getting most of it as regular special ed money. I think next year we'll get it mostly as mental health money.
Okay, that was my question, was whether it was considered categorical general fund
yes,
money.
It's
and it's
categorical
money. Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Based on attendance and just gave a base year plus COLA. So it's usually pretty consistent. So for some reason it went up by quite a bit this year, which we didn't find out about until July. So that was another increase to the state revenues. And then, of course, local revenues always go up throughout the year. They're facility fees and donations that we don't know what we're going to get until we get them, so we don't budget those right away. Our expenditures actually went down a little bit in certificated salaries, actually substantially, and that's due to the 3% that we budgeted for the teacher salaries for the raise, and they won't be getting that in 11-12, obviously. They may be getting it in 12-13, so when we get to the next page, you'll see that as a designation. Employee benefits went down a little bit, too. That's based on the teacher raises. And, of course, the materials and supplies is where most of the schools and departments have most of their money budgeted. So at the end of the year when they have carryovers, that's usually the account that has the biggest decrease between the budget and the actuals. So you can see between the increase in the revenue and the decrease in the expenditures, our ending fund balance went up to $21,362,000. Our deficit went down from $8,857,000 to $4,464,000. If you can go to the next page. However, we do have these things that we need to set aside. We've got the 10% for economic uncertainty. We have our restricted ending balances, which the state still considers restricted. We can't touch those, so that's $591,000. Our resource balances came in at about $4,514,000. That one-time revenue never really changes. That's $110,000. And then the 12-13 trigger cut, if the tax initiative does not pass, we're going to designate in case it doesn't. That's going to be about $3.2 million. And from what we've been hearing, the likelihood is very good that if it doesn't pass, that reduction is going to occur in this year. Normally for basic aid districts, it's the next year. So we need to make sure we set that aside for that. Most of the things below that are carryover, except for the agreement with SLCTA, which you can see we're setting aside that 3% for them if the evaluation system gets approved, which leaves an unappropriated ending balance of $1,593,000. Did you have anything to say? Do you have any questions?
Mrs. Sheffer?
Why is the MA reimbursement so much lower?
The MA reimbursement, we designate some of that for the sites, and the sites have discretion on how they want to use that, and some of it stays in a district account. And the reason we did that was because for years they've been talking about eliminating the MA reimbursement. But now that we are in such a deficit, we've decided that we're just going to let that roll into the general fund to help cover some of these other expenses. So the carryover that you see, the $34,803, is actually the site carryover.
And then the $1 million plus has moved down into the unappropriated column. So it's not like the money disappeared.
No.
We just changed its classification or its characterization.
And there is information on the other funds in your packet. I don't know if anybody had any questions on those. There weren't any significant changes.
Okay. Bring it to the back to the public. Is there anyone from the public that would like to address the board on this item? Okay, seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board. Are there other board questions that people have? Okay. You're looking for a motion to accept the unaudited actuals?
Yes.
Okay, then we'll take a resolution on item 8.01, approval of unaudited year-end actual financial statement.
I so move.
Moved by Mr. Millar and seconded by Mr. Quisenberry. Okay. Any other discussion? Seeing none, I'll bring it back for a vote. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Carries 7-0.
Mr. President?
Yes.
One final comment on this, and thank you very much for approving the unaudited actuals. The budget as it ended for 2011 ended for us in a positive and a negative way. The negative part of it is that we still spent more than we took in, $4.5 million. The positive part of it is that through the process of managing the budget and watching the expenditures happen, there was a savings of $4 million. Much of that was attributed to the timing issue of the teacher's raise and the implementation of the new evaluation instrument.
In replacement for other mental health monies that were coming down from the state and that were expected to spend that money, and mental health services necessary for our students, it can be quite expensive. All it takes is a few students that have to be placed out of our county, and that money is eaten away pretty quickly. We're also spending it on services at our classrooms and our classrooms for students with emotional disabilities.
Correct.
And probably on our school sites as well.
Yes.
I think that's really important.
The mental health component was welcomed and unexpected in the sense that we had these expenses to pay. We were going to have to pay them because they're expensive and they're required by law to actually get that allocation instead of the services from the county mental health people was, for us, a positive thing, in my opinion.
Right, and I think it's fair to say that the funds that we're spending on this were money that was being spent by social services, Department of Mental Health, that we're now being forced to spend or are spending on our students. So it's not a giveaway. It's not like we all of a sudden have a lot of cash for something like this.
That's correct.
Correct?
The greatest benefit is it allows the flexibility to do what the student needs instead of what we need to do within DSS, Department of Social Services, and county mental health contracts. It allows us to put services into the classrooms. It allows us to look at the IEP services and needs. Does the student need a specialized classroom or out-of-county placement? We're able to flex those funds for the student and not be kind of in a box. I think that's the greatest benefit, that the money has filtered to the districts and it's in local control now.
Okay, any other questions? Great. Okay, let's move on then to item number 8.02. That's approve the letter of response to the grand jury report. Dr. Prater.
Yes, I would like to start by acknowledging the board for your feedback. And you gave me some excellent direction in terms of how you felt. And so the letter that is in draft form before you is prepared, barring feedback or modification, for your approval. And it will be a public document for the whole county to see. So I want you to feel comfortable with it, and I just want to thank you for your feedback on that, and I think it accurately reflects the feedback I heard from you, and so I leave it to you to weigh in on before I push the send button to the Superior Court judge.
Is there anybody from the public that would like to address the board on this item? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board. Is there board comments? Mr. Millar.
I just would like to commend staff and Dr. Prater. I think it's very comprehensive and very cogent, but it communicates our view in a professional but forceful way, and I wouldn't change a thing.
Other board comment? Mrs. Rudder.
Well, while Mr. Millar commends staff, I see that this letter is over the signature of Board President Unger. So I'm sure that he burned a lot of midnight oil writing this. It is beautifully written. I think it underscores all of the important points that were omitted from the grand jury findings as they relate to basic aid school districts, and I wholly support sending this letter as submitted to us today.
Well, I wish I could take credit for the writing of this letter. I had a little feedback in it, I think, as did the rest of you, and it's a group project, and I think it really well expresses our concerns about the grand jury report and states our position, as Mr. Millar said, quite forcefully. So I think the kudos go to our staff for making this happen and giving voice to the board's feelings.
And your honesty is much appreciated, Mr. Unger.
Anybody else? Okay, seeing no one, I'll bring it back to the board then for a vote. Would someone like to make a motion on this, please?
I would move that we accept the letter as written and push that send button.
Okay. We have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer and a second by Mr. Millar. Any other discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries 6-0. Move on to item number 8.03, network upgrade, phase one of wireless infrastructure improvement. Mrs. Samoes.
Good evening. I'm very excited to be here tonight because this project has been in the works, in the planning stages for well over a year, and it's been a real collaborative effort with our principals and administration and my staff. Why the priorities and the overall cost, just in a little synopsis for you. Phase one is in alignment with our Initiative 8, and these upgrades will improve the reliability of our existing infrastructure, much like we replace roofs and electrical upgrades when they're needed. It's the same thing with network. Those switches and all those devices that make everything work need to be upgraded periodically. Some of you were on the board several years ago when we did kind of a major upgrade at that time. So we're at that cycle again where we need to start that, and we're ready to award a contract. We went out to bid. So I'll tell you a little more about that in a second. So you already allocated some funds for this year, and we issued a bid or a comprehensive request for proposal, and this gets us going on our Initiative 8. The newer infrastructure, as I mentioned, will improve the speeds, and we have that wonderful fiber optic network, so having those devices be modernized and upgraded will allow us to use the fiber network more fully. And then the priorities are listed there. Step one, we would upgrade the oldest infrastructure. Our middle schools have some of the oldest network parts. They were two of the first schools to be upgraded in the last round because part of the funding was from the EETT grant. So some of those switches were funded through the grant, and the rest of it was done through our district general fund at that time. This was 7 years ago. The next step would be, of course, to provide that Wi-Fi, and we'd like to start at the middle schools and do a little bit at the high schools. One of the reasons to begin at the middle schools is in preparation for the STEAM pilot that the district is looking at to implement at Los Osos next school year. So that's one of the initiatives, the science, technology, engineering, arts, and math pilot. And then the cost is listed for you there. So we would start with Los Osos as our base bid, then Laguna. So the first phase one would include both middle schools, and we also have some parts at the district that need to be upgraded to be able to get the speed out to the middle schools. And then the two additions would be for our comprehensive high school libraries, the media centers. The libraries are really the hub of our high schools, and so that's a great place to start, get them upgraded with the switches that lead to the libraries and provide the Wi-Fi there, so that if we want to, if the high schools are interested in looking at a bring your own device initiative where students can bring smartphones or tablets from home, they'll be able to use the Wi-Fi in the libraries. And we already updated our technology responsible use policy to allow for that. As the schools wish to implement, they can. So essentially, phase one will, as I said, upgrade at the middle schools and provide the two libraries at the comprehensive high schools. And then on the next page, you'll see each of the vendors. We had two proposals submitted, Decotech Systems and Vector Resources. And the actual proposal, the request for proposal, was posted on our consultant's website, Infinity Communications. Both vendors were evaluated fully. There was a variety of criteria, including price, accuracy of their bid response, experience, qualifications, and their level of service. We contacted all their references, and I heard some excellent references. So we felt that Decotech and our consultants agreed, felt that they were our most qualified bidder, and also the most cost-effective. So we're getting our bang for our buck. And so the funds have already been allocated, and I'll be glad to answer any questions. I'm going to move to recommend when you're ready, if you're ready, after discussion, that we can approve the request for proposal and move forward with Decotech.
Okay. I'm going to go to the public to see if there's anyone from the public that would like to address the board on this. And seeing no one, I'll bring it back to the board. And I think Mr. Ballard and then Mr. Quisenberry and Mrs. Roger.
Amelia, am I remembering correctly that Pacific Beach had a upgrade to their media center library and some of their technology?
They did. They got a new switch and some new computers, actually, a couple of years ago. They needed to expand their library lab that is in there. Right. They just had a few computers at one point, so we did, I believe, double the size.
Okay, thank you.
But for clarity, it wasn't a Wi-Fi system that was installed there.
Okay. Is that part of the plan? Is that I don't see PB on here, that PB would be upgraded as well?
Not at this time. What we tried to do is stick within the 100 left over. We picked one area at both schools that might profit best for the installation of a beginning of a Wi-Fi network, and that's why that was established. The Instructional Services Department and basically staff agree that the best bang for the buck at this point when you're first installing your system is in the middle schools, and then to follow the middle school students with an installation at the high schools as time goes.
Yeah, I expect to see a drop in cost, too, as with all technology. As time goes on, we'll be able to hopefully do more at the high schools at a lesser cost next year or the following, whenever we have the next round of funding available.
Dr. Prater, I think you had a comment.
Yeah, Mr. Quisenberry, I'd like to echo what Mr. Miller just said. Earlier last year, a group of us, led by Amelia, went to visit a superintendent, I believe, in San Bernardino. Is it San Bernardino or Riverside?
Riverside. Mm-hmm.
And he has started these pilot programs like we're doing now, but he started at the high schools and did some pretty innovative things. And in hindsight, his recommendation was, after watching it unfold, was that you're better suited programmatically to begin at the middle school on a smaller canvas and allow the kids to create the demand as they move up into the high school. So it actually, his mind was, start at the high school, move down middle, then elementary. And he literally changed his recommendation and said if he could do it over again, he would begin at the middle school where the kids have that independence, that emerging independence, yet when they move up and become familiar with it as they move into the high school, they literally pressure the system from the inside out as opposed from the outside in. And so it's less expensive to do the middle schools first. It happens to be they're our oldest infrastructure. And we believe we have the willingness there within that canvas, if you will, to they're inspired to really apply this technology as a tool within a STEAM model. And we believe that as the kids move up into Morro Bay and San Luis High Schools in particular, that in the next few years we'll see an increased demand for that technology from the kids. And so we believe that's the best path to take, which is why you see the recommendation the way you do.
My initial question was answered, I think, by Mr. Miller. We had previously allocated $800,000 for this work.
Correct.
In looking at, we're at $655,674 for the middle school's portion of the work, and then another $67,000, close to $68,000 for Morro Bay High School, $62,000 for Slo High. So I am wondering, or I am concerned, I guess I should say, that the benefit that we're providing to Morro Bay and San Luis Obispo High School may not become available to Pacific Beach High School until phase 3 or 4.
It's potential. We don't know yet when it will become available. But let's remember what this is. This isn't a restructuring or a reproduction of our current networking system, which was installed at a vast cost, $10 million, 15 years ago. This is a delivery system for the classroom. And the most classrooms that we can hit with the best value is at the middle schools, followed by the high school. And frankly, I think we have Pacific Beach in with the two comprehensive high schools in our staging. Whether it makes it or not will depend on the costs eventually and our affordability. But where we're looking at this is the installation of a Wi-Fi system to enhance the education in the classroom. That's the key piece.
We're talking about in the media centers, the library media centers?
That's a good point. But what we're doing with the comprehensive high schools in the media centers is we're enabling the teachers to come into the media center and teach on a platform of interactive, immediate access to the internet and other tools that aren't available within our current fiber optic network. So it's a different yet more powerful teaching tool than we currently have. And even if it is in the media center or the library, it's still accessible to all of the teachers. They just have to schedule it. It'll be somewhat like a lab.
We have $15,000 left over. If it is, there'd be...
I'm sorry.
It's a much smaller space. So say it's $30,000. We have a shortfall of $15,000. Do we have facilities money that available that could be used to put...
Let me give you a potential solution to your concern or interest, and that is that at the end of this installation process, that should there be additional budget money available, we'll bring it back with a plan on how to put it at Pacific Beach's computer lab, and we'll go from there.
And we'll move them up the...
There you go. We couldn't do it tonight because we don't have any kind of bid or anything for it.
Yeah, I understand.
Okay, so I get what you're saying now. I'm sorry. And that's easily done, I think, in terms of actually counting on it to a certain extent. It won't be, as you say, that expensive.
It wouldn't appear so based on the numbers I'm seeing here.
No.
Okay, thank you very much.
We'll work on that piece.
And just a clarifying question for me as I hear this. So if we don't add alternate 2, then the comprehensive high schools basically will not have Wi-Fi access anywhere.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Oh, they'll have it strictly. Well, currently they have Morro Bay has a Wi-Fi laptop cart that they used last year for the Read 180 program. So they have that. And then they will have an iPad pilot this year in two algebra classrooms. So they have three stand alone. It's not going to be as comprehensive as this bid, but it's just Stanless, kind of a put-together piece together.
Does Stanless High Wi-Fi. Have any Wi-Fi access?
Not currently.
Okay.
I think the thing to remember about that aspect of it is that the Wi-Fi that we currently have at different sites is more or less like you have at home, and it's not robust. It doesn't engage a lot of ports for the attachment of tablets and iPads, but it works to a certain extent. It's
anything you add to it just
stands. Yes.
It does, and it's not as secure. This is going to be much more robust.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to support this. I'll feel better having specific language if somebody from the board who makes this motion would incur it, would add that about Pacific Beach High School. And there's sort of an emotional reason for that as well for me, is they really, if we recall a couple of years ago, they were the ones that really brought forward this idea of the need to have access through the classrooms and through the schools and to the students. And so... And to develop the policy, exactly. And so I feel pretty strongly that Pacific Beach needs to be included in this as well. So, Mrs. Roger.
If there's no further board discussion, I'm willing to make a motion. I just need to figure out how to word it. I move that the board... award the wireless network upgrade project RFP number 0361-12, which includes a Los Osos Middle School base bid of $412,064, Laguna Middle School at alternate one for $243,610, for a project total of $655,674 to Decotech Systems, Inc. If the board I further move that we include the alternatives provided under that bid for library media centers at the comprehensive high schools, Morro Bay High School and San Luis Obispo High School, bringing the aggregate total award to $785,715.58. I don't have a date on the bid, but that reference number should suffice.
Did you want to add language about Pacific Beach High School?
And that
we do that.
Mr. Miller will I'm not sure exactly how to do that most effectively.
Handle this item and then give direction to staff regarding the Pacific Beach and any remaining funds?
So we have a motion to accept the bid from Decotech System for Los Osos Middle School, Laguna Middle School, Morro Bay High School, and San Luis Obispo High School. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Seconded by Mr. Quesenberry. Any further board discussion? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board for vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carries 6-0. And then Mr.
Last spring when we were staying here late dealing with our budget has to do with bullying. This is in response to Assembly Bill 9, which amended education code in several areas, became law July 1st of this year, so it is important that we get it in front of you. It changed many things, including the 48900 section of Ed Code, which added bullying and cyberbullying as offenses that are subject to potential suspension or expulsion. I won't go through the entire item for you, but we can point out any areas that you need to know. Basically, it talks about bullying prevention, which I think we do a pretty good job of with our elementary Steps to Respect curriculum, some of the middle school programs, cyberbullying presentations. We've already updated our student responsible technology use section about cyberbullying. It has a section in here about the posting of information, so we are working on some posters that we will be putting into classrooms so students know where to report or how to report if there are instances of bullying. It also mentions that this is an affirmative policy in the sense that all staff members are now, just as we have with child abuse reporting, are responsible for taking action, immediately intervening to stop an incident when it is safe to do so. So everyone's on notice that they can't just ignore bullying behavior. And as far as our protocols, we will be utilizing the same procedures, site-level procedures that are in our sexual harassment policies, which are probably our most detailed in terms of respecting privacy and confidentiality, investigating situations in a really time-specific manner and issuing reports and using the reasonable pupil standard for how we go about doing things. Just so the board is aware, this did become law July 1st, so we did make sure we put it. I know you haven't approved the policy, but we put all the information in our parent booklet of information as far as the fact that that bullying is now a suspendable and or expellable offense. And one comment before I hear feedback from you, Mr. Buckman has, who is not here this evening, has suggested that it may be prudent to put somewhere in the policy that something that to the effect that beyond what happens in a school system, there are potential criminal or civil charges that could be brought in for cases of bullying. It's not typically what we have in policy, but I that's in front of you because he did bring that suggestion forward. So I'm available for any questions.
I'm going to see if there's anybody from the public that would like to address the board. And seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board. Mrs. Sheffer and then Mr. Quesenberry.
With this new law, Mr. Robinette, are teachers receiving any professional development or any kind of training to make sure that this is applied fairly, equally, and consistently?
We have not instituted any specific training as of this time, so it's something that we're probably going to need to focus some attention on.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sheffer. You asked my question. You answered or got an answer to my question. The other issue I have with this, regarding staff development, actually there's two things. One, did the state allocate any additional funding for that?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. So staff development is required, but it's mandated, but there's no money to pay for that.
And I haven't seen this become a mandated cost yet either. Okay. So.
Secondly, Are we going to approach it, do you think, as far as staff development, the way we did with the sexual harassment policy, where there was sort of an online tutorial and follow-up assessment, I guess?
Yeah, that's a good way to go. That's been the way we've done many kind of broad-based things. We used either our CISC site or our SIPE site, those two acronyms, to have online training and sexual harassment. We've done it with bloodborne pathogen training, just as a way of making sure all staff is aware of what they're responsible for, how to report things, what they're supposed to do. It's a clean way of getting it done through everybody. It's not necessarily the most robust way, but it assures us that we're taking care of the law.
Are these things available, or do you know if they're available yet?
I have not research the site to see if they're available yet. This is kind of one of those laws that were sprung fast and said July 1st it goes into effect, and CSBA kind of ran fast to get a policy out. It's unclear even in the law whether the board has to adopt a policy or whether the district just establishes policies about this. So, you know, I don't know of that yet.
Just a question. This is a speculation, I suppose, on your part, but on page 8.01.2, it says at the bottom, the district may provide students with instruction.
The cyberbullying part. We haven't figured out what specifically we may need to do with just bullying.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm with Mr. Quesenberry. I think that we really need to develop staff development for this, and I think for all, not only probably school site staff, but district staff as well, who knows, you know, it could be the custodian, it could be the bus driver, it could be the site secretary who's the first, as it were, the first responder to something like this. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage us to look at that and the other piece of courses. If we're going to hold people responsible for responding to bullying, that they need to know what their responsibilities are and
correct.
What they need to be looking for. So I would support it with that.
And we'll make sure we write those into our ARs and right. take action.
Mrs. Roger?
Yeah, I agree that we do need to provide information to people on how to appropriately respond to students who might share that this is happening to them. And you're right, they won't necessarily just go to a teacher. They may go to a custodian or the lunch lady or anyone with whom they, you know, have formed a bond. But if this puts all of those employees in the position of being a mandated reporter, would you say, Mr. Robinette, that that's what it does under the law?
Well, under the rewrite of the Ed Code section, Ed Code 234, it indicates that school staff, which means everybody, shall immediately intervene to stop bullying. So it sounds like mandated reporting. It sounds similar.
In which case, I know what the repercussions are for not reporting if you're a teacher, but what might they be if you're a classified employee?
I don't know. I know that with mandated child abuse reporting, that used to be only certificated employees. Now it's everybody across the board is a mandated reporter. If you work for a school district, it's part of the paperwork you sign when you become an employee, that you're agreeing to become a mandated reporter as a condition of employment. I don't know how the law applies to this one, honestly.
I think that's a really interesting question, because I know as a mandated child abuse reporter, I'm obligated to do that, otherwise I'm breaking the law.
Right.
And it would be interesting to find out if those same penalties occur to school site staff who don't report bullying. I can't imagine they are, but I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe could we delve into this a little more? I mean,
certainly.
I am particularly I'm concerned any time a child is hurt, but I'm particularly concerned because friends of ours did lose a high school child to suicide this summer as a direct result of cyberbullying. So then I know that it happens, and I know that it it is a very serious issue. Mr. Buckman's suggestion that students be made aware.
Students and staff.
Students and staff. Okay, well, staff certainly will be made aware and will be in-serviced in some way on it. But Mr. Buckman gave you information. He was proposing that we allow students to know that it's against the law and they can be...
That besides whatever school district discipline could be imposed, that there are also the potential for criminal legal remedies that could be sought or could be imposed.
I'm wondering how my fellow board members feel about that suggestion from Mr. Buckman.
I was going to move approval of the minutes. I don't think it needs to be under.
That sounds to me more like an AR. I'm not. It doesn't sound to me as if it would be something that is part of a board policy, but I think it's important for we talk about in the bullying prevention and provide students with instruction. It feels to me that that's why it feels like an AR to me, not part of the board policy.
Other
comments? Okay, it doesn't look like there's support for Mr. Quisenberry.
This just goes back to the staff development issue, and I'm not sure I heard what I was hoping to hear, which is, yes, we're going to do that. I think Mr. Unger said it much more clearly than I.
plan a study session or board workshop, you specifically wanted the secondary administrators to participate in so that you could better understand their view on expulsion and their experiences, and it could be an opportunity to talk both ways. I believe that this conversation or this topic is part of that whole component of culture of care. It goes not just inside the classrooms, but it's in the hallways. It's how we become aware of what's really happening, both in the law and on the ground with the daily lives of students and staff. So I think it's part of a much more global picture that I would welcome in the framework of a study session with I believe the conversation around expulsion, professional development, where the county has requested, they're putting together a training with Dr. Bacon, I believe, on cultural competencies. And I believe it's the beginning of heightening our awareness as to what is really happening with kids and what they're going through. And if our staff isn't brought along with that, we put them in harm's way. And I think that's the essence of what you were getting at, Mr. Quesenberry, I believe. And so I think it's part of a bigger conversation beyond professional development. I think it needs to start with a very specific conversation about how are we putting these pieces together for our staff and for our students to keep everyone safe. To me, that's what it's about.
Okay. Would someone like to make a motion? I think you started, Walter. Do you have an interest in continuing that?
I'll move approval of Board Policy 5131.2.
I'd second that.
So we have a motion and a second. Is there any further board discussion? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board. All in favor of proposed new bullying policy 5131.2, say aye. Aye. Opposed. Carries 6-0. Let's move on to item number 8.05, proposed new board policy 1114, Community Relations District-Sponsored Social Media. This is a second reading. Mr. Robinette.
All right. Thank you. The board asked last meeting to bring this back for a second reading. I think the intent was just to make sure that the members who were absent at that meeting, Dr. Eisenrath Rogers and Mr. Unger, were just able to weigh in on it. I don't know if you want me to go through the policy again. Basically, it is supporting the idea that we as a school district are engaged in district-sponsored social media, which includes My Big Campus and Facebook and blogs and Twitter and all that kind of thing, and making sure we have policy in place which delineates what it is and what it isn't, that it is not intended to create a limited public forum. We do have the right to monitor it, that we will protect confidentiality, that we will not put records on this type of a platform that would be considered private, and we would be following all of our acceptable use policies and our practices. Again, available for any questions you may have.
And I'll bring it to the public to see if anyone would like to talk to us about this item. And seeing no one, I'll bring it back to the board. Are there questions from board members about this? Okay, I'm not seeing any. Then we'll bring it back for open. Someone like to make a motion?
Acceptance of this policy on district-sponsored social media.
We have a motion. Do we have a second? Okay, it's been moved by Dr. Eisenrath Rogers, seconded by Mr. Millar. Any further board discussion? Seeing none, I'll bring it back for a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries 6-0. Let's move on to item number 8.06, and that would be Dr. Prater.
During the last meeting, we did not have a full consensus on the board. We had two board members not present, and over the discussion of rethinking or repositioning our time frame for when we meet for board meetings from 7 o'clock start to 6 o'clock start. And what I heard was that you wanted to come back to this when Dr. Eisenrath Rogers could weigh in, as well as I believe, Mr. Unger. And thank you. And so what I had heard was a reluctance to change the time frame, but I just wanted to bring it back for the second review.
Well, not being here, I want to say that I would love to see the meetings start earlier. I think it would be more convenient for the staff. I actually think it would be more convenient for the public.
That's it. So it's just for the board to weigh in on. There's no pressure beyond. This is fully your decision.
Well, I do appreciate the merits of it. I can everything that Mr. Unger has identified is for the staff and for the public, and just when we have the you know budget meetings, for example, that go on so late into the night that you're almost incapable of forming a thought. So I do understand all that. At the same time, I'm sensitive to the members of the board who are working 9 to 5 and how difficult that would be for them. So I'd like to just try to air all of that and consider all of those issues.
Great. Mrs. Roger and then Ms. Checker.
Thank you. That was my point at the last meeting, is that I think that if we change the meeting time to 5 o'clock, it potentially precludes people who work conventional jobs from board service. We have a board right now that has a lot of latitude. And so for us, it may, you know, feel like a good idea, but we can't really expect employers to accommodate the needs of their employees if it interferes with their business objectives. So that if we have a meeting on the coast and we have a closed session beginning at 5 o'clock for a board member who is elected in San Luis to get there, I think it may not be possible. So I think that unless we want to contemplate in the future having only board members who are self-employed or retired, we need to be conscious of the fact that people who work 9-to-5 jobs work 9-to-5 jobs. And I do understand that it is easier for staff, but I'm a little less concerned about that. For parents, I don't know which would be easier for parents, 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock. Quite frankly, we don't see that many parents at our meetings on a regular basis unless we have an agenda item up that they want to address or make a show of support about.
And I would, last time, just to reiterate a couple of points I made, that I do have a traditional job with a lot, with a, good employers who appreciate my board service, but I feel that in the traditional job world that may be the exception rather than the rule. My suggestion would be that this be something that is discussed with the board each time there are new members, or that somehow people know. I'm concerned that people who might consider serving or running for office might not do so if they think that it would they would have to make a choice between their day job and this second job. So that's my concern.
I will offer an opposing point of view on that as I think about it, though. If we're trying to attract board members, for example, who have children, the later the hour gets, the more difficult it is for people who have children to get home to. You know, that, so they become concerned about it's 9 o'clock, it's 10 o'clock. You know, I have children to get to bed tonight. Just a thought, because while we're also looking for people who are working in the community, we may at some point want to be able to include more members who are able to.
Yeah, whatever appears children. To be the more inclusive route, mm-hmm. that's my concern.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, the counterpoint too. You've got your. We don't want to exclude your senior members of the community from board service either. We sure as hell would like to get home a little earlier. So.
Would there be an interest? I'm sensitive to 5 o'clock closed sessions, and I understand how that could be difficult, especially if, well, for people working on the coast, it's difficult to get into town here, and for people in town, it would be difficult to get on the coast. And my interest is to keep meetings both in town and on the coast. I think that's
adjusting the time based on our particular needs. And so I would suggest that maybe we say that they're normally held in the evening on the first and third Tuesdays, and then we have the flexibility to pick whatever time the board composition at any given time prefers.
I would support that. I think that since the meetings are televised, and I think most people like to watch the meetings. In fact, one thing that I'd love to see at some point in the future is live streaming of our meetings so that people could actually watch us in action and maybe even email us questions. That might be kind of interesting. I would support Mrs. Holmes' idea, but the question still is, do we want to keep... I would go for the language change, but as a board, what would the consensus be then on what time we want to regularly meet? Well, why don't we see if we have support for Mrs. Holmes' language, and then we can, as a board, we can come up with, once we get the language on, then we can come up with a consensus on what we want our regular hour to be or our approximate regular hour to be. So would somebody like to make a motion on this board policy with a substitution of from 6 to 7 p.m. held in the evening on the first and third Tuesdays at the announced school site?
I would so move that we accept the policy with that slight change.
Okay. Do we have a second on that?
I will second.
Dr. Eisenrath-Rogers seconds. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the board for vote. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Carries 6-0. Then I think as a board, what's our consensus on when we want our meetings to begin, or do we want to vary it? I don't know. Could we say 6 o'clock if there was no closed session? Would that be acceptable? 7 o'clock if there's closed session? 6:30? I don't know. I'm kind of bartering time here.
Well, one aspect of it is the clerk and president and superintendent are going to be the ones who are going to be the most knowledgeable about the demands of a particular agenda. And, I mean, we could always take a straw vote at the end of the previous meeting, more or less dependent upon changes in each individual trustee's schedule. We know we're going to meet next September 18th.
But we don't know the agenda.
We don't, but we might know what time we want to, you know, if nobody, since it's out in Los Osos, Ellen may have trouble getting there by 6 o'clock start time, so it seems more likely that this would be a meeting we'd keep at 7 o'clock. If we're here in J2 and we know it's a summertime agenda, then we might want to start it at 6 o'clock.
I suppose if we had some, I don't mind having consistency for the sake of those, everyone who attends. I mean, for me, for now, to say that we'll have closed session at 5 and the meetings begin at 6, that's okay. I can do that. I think my concern is more, you know, for on down the line or, you know, future board members to not feel that this is a schedule that's carved in stone. So that's, I appreciate the ad hoc approach. I think that certainly provides the flexibility and ability to accommodate schedules that I'm seeking. And I do think if we decide each time, then that may create some confusion for people who may wish to attend.
So I'm still not getting kind of a feeling for where people want to go. We've got the flexibility now to start the meetings whenever we want. Do we want to say our meetings will typically start at 6 o'clock, closed session at 5? However, we can have flexibility on that. For example, if Catherine, you get a new job or something like that, and all of a sudden you have to work till 5 o'clock, then the board will need to start meeting later. We can't do that. We can't disenfranchise a board member by the policy of starting a meeting early to essentially keep them from participating. That's not okay by me.
Here's another swipe at it. Yeah. We could have the meetings consistently start at 6, and then we could do things with closed session to accommodate the individual concerns or scheduling problems of a board member. In other words, the public will know the meeting starts at 6. Where we can do it, we have our closed session at 5.
But that's just my opinion.
So it seems like you have some reservations about this. Staff, how do you feel? Do you feel like we can accommodate typically a 6 o'clock start, given the... Marilyn, would you be able to come at 5 o'clock for closed session?
At this time. If I was to be employed,
then you wouldn't
not
be able.
Necessarily.
Okay. All right.
So I would have to consider resigning my...
Well, I don't think that's... That's not something that anybody on the board has an interest in for any board member. If they can't get here because they have a job, I personally think it's pretty important for people to work and be able to support themselves and their families. Then the board service is really important too. But you know, for us to say you can't, we're not adjusting something for any member that's just not right. That's disenfranchising the public, since we're all elected by the public. Personally, I'd like to see us start early. I'd like to see us start at 5 when we can and start the meetings at 6. But I can adjust, for the most part, I can adjust my job so that I can be available at 5 o'clock. I mean, if that ever changed, then I would have to come back to the board myself and I would have to ask for the meeting to be changed, meeting time to be changed. And I think we have the flexibility now to do that. I don't know. Does that satisfy you? Okay. Everybody okay with that? All right. Okay. Let's move on to item number 9, action consent. Please let me know if you want to have anything pulled. Let me just get to that spot. Approval of certificated and classified personnel items, disposition of surplus property, acceptance of donations, approval of warrants and payroll, and destruction of records. And I'm not seeing anything pulled. Is there anybody from the public that would like to address the board on an action consent item? Seeing no one, I'll bring it back to the board. Would someone like to make a motion for 9.01 to 9.05?
I'll move approval of 9.01 through 9.05.
We have a motion and a second by Mr. Quesenberry. Any further comment from the board? Seeing none, I'll bring it back for a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carries 6-0. Let's move on to item number 10.01. I'm sorry, 10.02. Let's try. These numbers are killing me. How about item 10.03, advanced agenda? Is there anybody that would like to propose anything for the advanced agenda? And seeing no one, then we'll close that item. We don't need to take any action on that. Item number 11, information reports by board members. Is there anybody that would like to make a report to the board or to the public? Mr. Quesenberry.
Not so much a report as an announcement. The Los Osos Rotary, along with the Baywood PTA parents, are hosting the 5th Annual Grandparents' Day
That's Sunday, September the 9th, from 11 to 3. There'll be activities. It's called a multi-generational. I'm having trouble speaking. Multi-generational event. There'll be live entertainment, activities for the children, and we do have a raffle.
And where would that be, sir?
At Baywood School on the playing field.
And what time again?
From 11 a.m. to 3 p.m.
And that's
September the 9th.
Sunday the 9th. Okay. Is there anybody else that has any board announcements? Seeing none, I'll declare this meeting adjourned until 6 o'clock, September 18th at Los Osos Middle School. Thank you. Thank you.